session number 177747, reel 2.
You went before a panel anyway, if you were due to...
to serve.
To join the forces, partly to see whether you wanted to put in for deferment, and partly to find whether, as a cadet, even at the lowly level of the Certificate A, you had preferences, what to go into. And that was the point at which I knew that I had a hope of getting into the Royal Artillery, because I said, A, that I, on the whole, I did not want to apply for deferment. In other words, I would let my call-up proceed, which I could have prevented from happening with their support. I didn't want to defer my call-up, and I did want to go into the Royal Artillery, and I was asked why, and I said, and this is quite genuine, that I had a considerable interest in map reading, which I had done through A-level geography at school, and map making, use of surveying equipment. And I thought this might be quite useful in the gunners, at which they nodded sagely, and duly I was called up to the gunners 2 months later.
Had you ever considered the Royal Engineers?
No, I hadn't, because I assumed that one would need to have a scientific bent. I was probably quite wrong about that. It might have been a good idea, but I had been on the arts side at school, and engineers, mental association with engineering, and an engineer I wasn't. But gunners I might be, and I was. That's what I went into. So when I was called up, it was to a Royal Artillery Field, a signals training regiment in Lancashire. Now, how would you like me to take it from there? We've jumped from student to signaller.
Well, I'd like to ask you what happened when you arrived at your...
Oh, yes, you raised the question of how were you inducted, and what I've given you, what happened at Nottingham as a student, was the first stage of induction, and it left one with a feeling of being someone slightly special, that you had chosen to go into into the army rather than be deferred. You'd chosen what regiment you would like in broad terms of the artillery, and any thoughts of being specially noted in any way were rudely shattered on the 25th of September 1941, when after a very long 7-hour train journey from Cleethorpes in Lincolnshire to a small mill town outside Preston in Lancashire, place being Mamba Bridge, this happened. And one was then right into the army, into the thick of it. I think it must have been much harder for anybody 10, 15, 20 years older. At 19, you are fairly resilient. And this was one of the pluses of having been... You asked earlier whether there was any mileage in having been in the cadets, whether it was useful preparation. It was a useful mental preparation for the hassle, the bullying, and so on. I don't mean serious bullying. I mean the hectoring by NCOs. And you had learnt already as a student half into the army to take all this with a pinch of salt. And so you were not daunted, as some people must have been, by going into a disused cotton mill in the early evening of September and being ordered about and being not measured, but trying on certain uniforms, boots, all the rest. You took it in good part.
Were you physically fit?
Yes. Well, I was A1 at that time. I came out of the army 4.5 years later as A2 because of some development of a bronchial condition. But yes, I was not ever a tremendously athletic person. I mean, I was slender. I weighed about less than 10 stone. I was height 5 foot 10 and a half, so I was thin. I was agile. I had been a good jumper at school and a moderate runner, but I would never have made a rugger player. So I was fit but not tough.
Had the OTC done any physical training to prepare you for?
Oh, would have been the usual camps of having to get on your belly and squirm forward with rifles and Bren guns. Military training is itself, at least in parts, is a fitness thing. I mean, you doing gun drill, doing marching drill, doing things double.
Basic, but you've done basic infantry.
Yes, basic infantry, that's right.
And, I mean, had they concentrated at all on PT as part of that training? Or
I think there was some PT, but I think there was also unarmed combat. I suppose something approaching jiu-jitsu, I'm not sure how it would be categorised, but there was quite a lot of physical activity, but there wasn't an awful lot of time, really. I mean, all of these things happened after the normal lecture hours in the university. Although, as a history student, I had precious few lectures. My time was largely free. I mean, at least half of the students were scientists who had full days in laboratories. So these things happened, if I remember rightly, about 4:30, 5:30 for a couple of hours in the evening. And, of course, there were weekend exercises. I could, by referring to diaries, no doubt find that I was on duty this or that day, but the general picture is, I think, as I've given it to you.
So you arrived at the cotton mill at Bamba. Was this your accommodation?
Yes.
You were living there?
Bamba Bridge, disused cotton mill, housing, I should think, 200 or 300 trainees, signallers. I'm trying to remember whether we were called gunner or signaller, but it was the same rank. We were put into rows of beds, 25 beds in one row and 25 in another row, and there are about four rows across. There should be 100 men on each floor of this cotton mill, with somewhere in the on the ground floor level was a naffy and, of course, dining hall. Across in some outbuildings were the row of cold water sinks and taps, which we... And then I think there may have been a provision for a shower bath once a week or once a fortnight, but mainly we just had these cold water troughs at which to wash and shave. And since razor blades were at a premium in those days, shaving in cold water was not very funny. That is a clear memory. So we had about 100 men. I've described this in some of my written accounts fairly vividly as being a process of lying through the night if you couldn't sleep, listening to grunts and snores and people going off noisily to the loo and this kind of thing. It was absolute mayhem. But particularly, there were some amusing sides to it. I mean, we were called up once one squad per fortnight. And the squad following mine, which was a fairly mixed one in terms of age, occupation, but the squad following mine was 25 bank clerks, all of whom brought striped pyjamas, and nobody else had thought of bringing any pyjamas into the army. It was not part of the kit. I have, incidentally, in the written material I have, a diagram of our required kit layout every morning before we went down to drills, the kit being inspected by the orderly officer and either condemned or okayed.
That was every morning, kit inspection?
It had to be laid out every morning, certainly, yes.
Did you have a locker as well as a bed?
We did not have a locker, no. I can't remember what we had except a little kit bag to, which would go, yes, it was a kit bag, which would go under the bed when not on display as part of the kit inspection. No, we didn't have lockers.
What was the bed? Was it the standard three planks on two trestles?
Or it was something? Iron bedsteads.
Iron bedsteads?
Yes.
Luxury.
Luxury, yes. That's right. No mattress, a palliasse.
Can you remember the syllabus of training?
I could find it out, but I can't remember it offhand, except that there were four sections. It was four and a half month training stint as signallers. We were being trained to run the cables, to man the wireless sets, to know how to tune a wireless set, and generally to know how to establish communications between observation posts and guns. That's the essence of the matter. And between guns and battery headquarters, and between battery and regimental headquarters, and anything back beyond that would be for the Royal Corps of Signallers. So basically, we were meant to come out as signallers, ready for posting to regiments. But since everybody was a gunner, we all had to know about gunnery as well, because you had to be ready to be brought in action conditions from your signalling to manning a gun if necessary. There had to be a certain amount of versatility. So we were trained on primarily signalling, but the first stint was to turn us into soldiers, and the first requirement was to turn us into soldiers. The second was to turn us into gunners. The third was to turn us into signallers, line and radio. And the fourth was to make sure that we were competent dispatch riders, because that is another part of communication. So we were trained on four things, at least. Soldiers, gunners, signallers, and drivers, dispatch riders. And after the war, I was able to write to the War Office, and they immediately produced a driving licence for my civilian life, which still includes a motorbike, even though I've never ridden one since I was a 19-year-old gunner. Oh, well, not much after that, anyway. Yes, we had, roughly speaking, a month on each of these four disciplines.
The first discipline, being made into a soldier, did you find that what you were being taught differed in any significant way from what you'd been taught in the OTC?
If it did, I can no longer remember. It was all square bashing, really, one form or another, and being taught the small arms, of course, Bren guns as well as rifles. We even had to go at anti-tank guns, 2 pounders I think they were, until we got eventually onto some 17 pounders much later.
Not the 6 pounder at all?
Yes, there must have been a 6 pounder. That's, you're quite right. It was 2 pounders and 6 pounds. The 17 pounder came along much later.
Was there a concentration on the Bren gun at the expense of the rifle?
The Bren gun was the most memorable because of the performances, the sort of thespian act that the sergeants went through in describing the Bren gun and attributing sort of semi-pornographic names to each of its parts. This was a competitive thing among corporals and bombardiers and sergeants to describe the Bren gun each more graphically than the next. There was a lot of concentration on the Bren gun. I don't know why. It was a fascinating weapon, and I suppose it was relatively new in the army, and the rifle was a rather fuddy-duddy thing compared with the Bren, yes.
I think it might be because when field batteries went into the field, they were issued with Bren guns for local defence.
Mm.
And it was the preferred weapon for defending a battery that might come under close attack by enemy.
Yes, well, I hadn't realised. I mean, obviously that did happen, but I hadn't realised it was a policy, because everybody, of course, had the rifle. At least I think they had. I'm just trying to remember now. You've raised a doubt in my mind whether our chaps had rifles in the field at all. It's strange the things one forgets. All I know is I had a revolver, but I don't remember.
Dispatch riders certainly generally carried a revolver rather than a rifle.
Yes.
Because the rifle yes. has been
encumbered. Yes, too much of an encumbrance. But you see, by the time I was in action, we were beginning anyway to be equipped with Tommy guns as well as Brens. And I simply cannot remember whether, when I was an officer, whether my gunners had rifles or not. How stupid not to be able to remember it, but I can't remember.
Well, if they never had to use them, then they wouldn't necessarily make much of an impact.
They're useful for mounting the guard.
What about the boys' anti-tank rifle? Did you ever see anything of that?
I did. A very noisy thing. It deafened you. Very powerful.
Recoil,
yes. Oh, a terrible thing. I was rather scared of that.
Do you remember if you saw it at Bamber Bridge, or whether this was just when you were at Nottingham?
It wouldn't be at either Bamber Bridge or Nottingham. It would be when we went on camps from Bamber Bridge. We went on exercises to North Wales, and it was on that kind of exercise that we would be seeing 25 pounders fired for the first time for real, and also doing some target practice with rifles and with Brens, and seeing anti-tank guns, and just having a short go each with a boy's anti-tank rifle, which bruised the shoulder.
When they were giving you this first 4 weeks of basic infantry training, soldiers, were they very hot on things like turnout and saluting? And
very much so, yes.
Of that sort?
Very much so, yes. Mm. Oh, yes. This was very evident. I mean, inspections for smartness, you know, haircut, dress not properly adjusted, all of this kind of thing, boots not shining adequately. I saw hapless bank clerks sitting up till the early hours with hot spoons heated over a candle, then dipped into the boot polish and smoothed over the rough soles of new boots to make them shine until you could see your face in them. There was a lot of bull.
Had you had any of that at Nottingham, or did that come as a shock?
No, it didn't come as a shock, because it had been there at Nottingham, although inevitably you couldn't require the same standards of boot polish at 6 o'clock in the evening after a day of doing other things as you could in the way you were a captive in the army.
What happened to you if you didn't come up to scratch? What sort of
potato bashing. Yes, you'd get confined to barracks, of course, for 3 days or whatever. You'd be one of the people. I mean, somebody had to be punished every day, otherwise the potatoes wouldn't have got peeled.
What was the food like, generally?
You have an infinite hunger when you're 19. The food, I guess, was not bad. At the same time, I suppose the final meal of the day was probably tea at about 5 o'clock or something. What I do know is that by 7 o'clock, we were all in the naffy eating pies. Increasingly, we went out. Freedom came after the formal evening meal. When I say formal, I mean the meal you had to stay for. It was by no means a formal meal. But then you scarpered out of the gates and hitchhiked into Preston, which was 3 miles away, and went to one of a variety of clubs run by well-meaning ladies to fortify you further. And indeed, you could be very well fed, very cheaply indeed, in these these places.
I mean, did this liberty begin immediately, or did you have to pass off the square, or go through any other sort of...
I think it came very quickly. I should think after about a week. And indeed, we were allowed home for a long weekend after 5 weeks. There was a three-day pass at the end of 5 weeks. And then a week's leave. This was September, end of October was the three-day pass. And then Christmas was coming on, and at Christmas we had a week's leave. And then there would be another three-day pass at the end of early February, I suppose. And we finished the course in about March.
Did anybody actually drop out or get relegated in your squad on the way through?
Can't remember. I think there probably were one or two dropouts, but I can't think what would happen to them because there was nowhere for them to go. Pioneer Corps, perhaps. You mean relegated to a further fortnight? There might have been. Mm. Yes, there might have been one or two of those. Mm. Not that the course was very demanding, and people, to be fair, had to an extent been been chosen. I mean, they presumably had been had opted for the gunners and had been found suitable. I've described how, as a student, I went through a minor sieve to get into the gunners. Mind you, that was with a view, obviously, to becoming a gunner officer. That's why that sieve existed for me. How people were otherwise chosen for the to be signalmen or ordinary gunners from civilian life, I don't know. But is it possible that there was some kind of selection at work? I don't know. They were quite reasonably bright people.
It varied a lot from command to command and arm to arm because they were getting into the business of using psychological assessments.
But at what point did they use them? To somebody who was being called up?
In some commands, people were interviewed by a board on which there would be a psychologist who would ask them certain questions to test their aptitude. But not in all. It really all depended upon the outlook of the commander of the district or region concerned.
Hmm. I mean, I have a vision of call-up papers being sent out through the post, which said you report to X or Y unit next Saturday or whatever. And I was just wondering at what point in this process anybody could have been assessed other than people like me who were in a rather special position.
Well, in some cases they'd go to a depot and they would be assessed there. They'd get a medical inspection and then they'd have an interview.
Yes, it's true. You're quite right. I mean, there had to be a medical inspection of everybody, and indeed there was. So it could have been a slight sieving at that stage.
Yes.
Medical plus...
plus interview with a psychologist.
Yes, that's right. So that could have accounted for their being... I mean, you know, they were not dim people on the whole. They're fairly obviously they were able to understand such technical stuff as one had to absorb for the signalling side, as well as there being a certain amount of very elementary theoretical gunnery, you know, about angles of sight and so on.
Ballistics,
yes, that's right.
Moving on to the gunnery, can you remember what sort of gun you trained on as a gun number?
Yes, we had 13-pounders and 18-pounders from the first war. We had no 25-pounders. I think there may have been one more or less on display in our Bamber Bridge barracks, but the 25-pounder was only then, I think, coming into mass production, and everything was needed to equip the fighting units rather than signals training units. So we had seen a 25-pounder, but we were not trained on it.
But you saw it firing when you went to Wales.
When we went to Wales, they were firing 25-pounders. We were firing 25-pounders.
You were firing
them. Yes, we were put onto gun teams to fire 25-pounders.
Did you have to train, you know, you presumably you trained to be number 1, 2, 3, 4 and so on. You went through all the gun numbers.
I think so, but of course the number one was a sergeant usually, and I'm just wondering whether they trusted us with that. I can't remember. I mean, there were 6 people in a sort of gun team, 25 pounder. It's either 5 or 6, you could manage with 5. But whether they let raw signals trainees onto a gun as number one, I suppose they did. I suppose they did in rotation, yes.
If you were just doing the drills with, dummy ammunition, it wouldn't really...
No, it wouldn't matter with dummy ammunition, but when it came to real firing, which we did see happen, I suppose it was done by proper gunners at that stage. It would have been too dangerous to let us loose on them.
Well, they might have let you act as loaders.
Yeah, that's right, or pull the cord, the lanyard or whatever. Yes. No, anyway, we were trained on 13 and 18 pounders.
Was most of the training practical, or was there a fair element of theory in it, classroom work in it?
There was some classroom work, but it was fairly limited. Most of it was running around these guns.
Who did the actual work of training? Was it mainly NCOs, or did you see a lot of officers?
It was mainly NCOs, sergeants, corporals, and bombardiers and sergeants. There would be officers around, usually 1 pippers, 2 pippers.
What sort of relationship did you have with the NCOs? Was it a formal relationship or informal?
Oh, it's hugely variable. I mean, this is why some of them got a bad name, others a good name. Some would be pally, off duty. Others would be remote. They were a mixed bunch. We had, my little squad, had a sergeant whose name was Fippin, who was obviously, for some reason, slightly out of place, or gave the impression of being, because he was quite obviously a public school boy and well educated, very well spoken. And why he was a sergeant training people in this field, this signal training regiment, I have no idea. He was different from all of the others, and he was one that we could go to, and as indeed we did, 3 or 4 of us together after a month, to say, look, what about putting in for a commission, you see, how do we set about this? And he was knowledgeable enough and bright enough to see the context of this.
What advice did he give you on that?
Oh, he told us to put in for an interview with the Major, which we did.
What happened next? How did the Major receive
Well, the Major, again, you see, training regiments, as opposed to sort of frontline regiments, did acquire some interesting officers. I say this because the Major, very unusually, was a Member of Parliament, Conservative Member of Parliament, called Sir Reginald Blaker. He was a baronet, a Member of Parliament, and presumably had to be found occupation. I mean, obviously he was a volunteer, didn't have to be there at all, but since he wanted to serve, it had to be somewhere where he could, if necessary, get to Parliament. And this is where they put him. Presumably it was about 3 hours from a fast train from Preston to Euston. And Major Blaker was a delightful man. And we went to see him and were interviewed by him individually, of course. When I say we, the others were students from Manchester University and another university, and a young solicitor. There were about 4 of us who were undergraduates of one sort or another, or professionals, or budding professionals, as opposed to the other 20 or so who tended to be from artisan occupations or shopkeepers, that kind of thing, 1 or 2 postmen. So when I say we asked about commissions, it was those who saw themselves as having some sort of possibility of becoming officers who did this. We were slightly cliquey, and we planned it together, and we did it at more or less the same time. Now, what else would you like me to tell you about that?
Well, what, you know, what sort of did the major ask you any questions in particular that you can remember?
Could I refer to my notes? Because I've written this down somewhere. Yes. We were saying you were asking what happened when I saw the major. He talked to me, no doubt eliciting more than I knew at the time what he thought about me. But he must have said I was okay to put in for a commission. And what I did was to put in for the regiment's next board for people who wanted to go for commissions. That was the stage after the major's interview, but with his permission.
So it was a preliminary filter there.
So he was filtering before the regimental board sat under the colonel. I had to produce entry forms and a birth certificate and a supporting letter from my headmaster. And I was interviewed for 5 minutes in January 1942 at regimental headquarters. I thought I'd put in a moderate performance.